Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's program, China's new government vows to abolish re-education camps. North Korea is in the news, and as tensions escalate, what will the future hold? Some people are worried about Indonesia's media freedoms, but many businessmen, in particular one, are saying there's no cause for concern. We have this and more on this week's edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. At the end of this week's China's annual session of Parliament, the National People's Congress, they will endorse a group of leaders who will immediately become some of the most powerful people in the world. While China analysts are still watching for any signs that the direction that the nation might take, the new leadership does appear to be already on the record for one key promise. Officials saying the incoming administration of Xi Jinping will abolish the much-hated re-education thought-through labor program. Its system of extrajudicial detention, in which dissidents and minor criminals are sent away to remote labor camps for many years, at times often without their family being notified. Stephen MacDonald has more.
In freezing and remote parts of China, there are some 350 labour camps, holding around 160,000 prisoners who didn't step into a courtroom before their detention. They've been judged by the local police or other officials to be in need of so-called re-education through labour, often for being troublemakers or dissidents, and face up to 4 years of deprivation, arduous work, and physical abuse. China's legal fraternity has been increasingly critical of this extrajudicial detention. Some say it's unconstitutional, but the security authorities have until now guarded their power to lock away whoever they want without the aggravation of going to court. The potential for this system to be abused is clearly enormous, and even the Communist Party's mouthpiece, The People's Daily, has described re-education through labour as having become a, quote, tool of retaliation for unscrupulous local officials. Some delegates to the National People's Congress sitting this week in Beijing have called for its immediate end, and now several senior legal officials have promised that by the end of the year, Laojiao, as it's called in Chinese, will be abolished. Pu Jiacheng is a lawyer whose clients include those who've been sent to the labour camps. The ABC asked him if he thinks this system is indeed about to be scrapped. I think it will be, he said. I believe to abandon Laojiao is not hard for the party, the government and the new leaders, and they'll be highly praised for doing it. Now, we also asked him if the government could be considering abandoning re-education through labour now because of the pressure it's receiving from many quarters. Yes, that's true. There's pressure from both inside and outside China, he said. Within China, there are a lot of people who want to abandon Laojiao to develop a society built on the rule of law. If China does abolish Laojiao, human rights groups say it'll be quite an achievement for the incoming government. It'll also be a huge put-down for China's powerful security establishment, which under Xi Jinping has already lost a seat on the seven-man Politburo Standing Committee. The fear, though, is that the administration may axe re-education through labour while retaining some other form of similar extrajudicial detention.
And that was Stephen MacDonald reporting from Beijing. It's no surprise that North Korea has escalated its hostile rhetoric now that South Korea has begun joint exercises with the United States. The question is whether Pyongyang will follow up with military action. The North is threatening to wipe out parts of the South, in addition to its announcement that it had already unilaterally scrapped an armistice agreement that has helped maintain an uneasy peace since the end of the Korean War. So will Pyongyang use the exercise as a pretext for retaliatory action? ABC Television's Jim Middleton spoke to Dr. Chung Min Lee, an international affairs specialist at Yonsei University in Seoul.
Well, I think they're using the key resolve exercise, which began, as you know, on the 11th and which goes to the 21st. And this is an issue that is really not new. In other words, Pyongyang can find all sorts of excuses to launch provocations on South Korea. And this basically is one provocation which they feel they can use. And I believe that they will do so for either a political or some type of a light military provocation. But of course, nobody really knows for sure what is going on in the minds of Kim Jong-un and his leadership in Pyongyang today.
Just how significant, or is it not, that Pyongyang has declared the ceasefire agreement null and void again, and also shut down at least some of the hotlines between North and South Korea?
Well, that's a very good point, because obviously they're taking their marker step by step. Previously, from about 10, 15 years ago, they have said the same thing over and over again. We will not abide by the armistice agreement. But they made it very, very clear that, legally speaking, the armistice agreement no longer exists. But, of course, the UN Security Council rebutted them and said there's no way that North Korea can unilaterally withdraw from the armistice agreement. So that's a minor point. But as you also recall, the North Koreans have lambasted the South Koreans for the exercise, for a number of other issues. And they're now saying that there will no longer be any normal relations between the new government of Park Geun-hye and, of course, Kim Jong-un. But they're using this as a pretext, and I think they will take some type of political or other types of action. And so, as far as South Korea is concerned, the armistice remains in place, and if they don't want to talk to us, we'll find other avenues of communication.
Now, here's something I do find curious. You have close connections to the new president of South Korea. During the election campaign, she promised a more moderate stance towards Pyongyang than her predecessor. And yet her election has been followed by more intense provocation from the North. That does seem counterintuitive.
You're absolutely right, because all the signals that Madam Park at that time as candidate sent over to Pyongyang was quite positive. But you recall last December they launched a long-range missile. Then they test-fired, of course, the third nuclear test this year. And so that was the welcome that Pyongyang had for the new administration here in South Korea, which convinces me that deep down inside, Kim Jong-un really has no desire to have a major political breakthrough with the South Korean government. What they're looking for is an excuse to get more aid, particularly cash in kind, which the new government is not going to provide to the North Koreans. So this is a ploy as far as I'm concerned. But as I said, the president has said, even through her unification minister just yesterday, that if North Korea wants dialogue and cooperation, the door is always open, even as they're threatening South Korea today.
But isn't conducting a nuclear test the one thing that would antagonize all the other players and simply prevent the resumption of aid, either in cash or kind?
You're absolutely right. And I think all of your viewers in Australia should also know this point, namely that China is the biggest benefactor of North Korea. They provide 70% of fuel and food to North Korea. And I think if you look at Xi Jinping, the new president and leader of China today, the North Korean issue is now one of his biggest foreign policy headaches. And so the Chinese really have to make a concerted effort to make sure that North Korea makes the right choice. And thus far, Beijing has supported, for example, the newest round of sanctions imposed on North Korea by the UN. So North Korea has gone against China. It has gone against the four major powers around the Korean Peninsula and, of course, the international community. It has bitten the hand that feeds it.
It does seem that, by the by, the new sanctions will not work unless China treats them seriously. Do you believe that Beijing will impose these sanctions rigorously, with some rigor?
I think the Chinese will try to follow the spirit of the sanctions, but whether they will take unilateral steps, that remains to be seen. The Chinese are extremely careful when it comes to North Korea. On the one hand, North Korea is one of their closest allies. They don't want to basically push North Korea into a corner. But on the other hand, they realize that if they coddle North Korea too much, the international community will no longer respect the PRC for the great power that it is. So China basically is stuck between, you know, a rock and a hard place. In the longer term, the most important sanctions that will hurt North Korea is finding out those secret bank accounts in China and elsewhere that is held by the North Korean regime. If the Chinese are able to go down that route, that will really hurt the Pyongyang government.
And do you think they will?
At some point in time, if that is the only leverage the Chinese have, they will, of course, use other means first. But that final option, that final super sanction, as it were, is not going to be considered for quite some time. But as I told you, the president of China, Mr. Xi Jinping, is going to realize that the same old business-as-usual model when it comes to North Korea is no longer work in the interest of China's longer-term foreign policy and economic interests here in the region.
I do notice that there has been commentary in China that Beijing should not join the US camp and make North Korea China's enemy. On the other hand, an academic at the Communist Party's Central Party School has written that China should consider abandoning North Korea. Is there something of a debate going on within the hierarchy in Beijing about how to handle North Korea, do you think?
That's a really brilliant question. And I think the answer is, on the outside, from the outside looking in, there is debate going on within the academia in China, policy specialists and so forth, but debate within the realms of government and the party, that's something we don't really know. But there are nuances, there are ad hoc comments that really did not appear as early as, say, 2-3 years ago. In other words, there are signals that the party is becoming very frustrated with the steps North Korea has taken. For example, you know, the late Chairman Mao Zedong's grandson, who is a two-star general in the army in the PLA, also said that North Korea should no longer go down the path of nuclear weaponry. I mean, imagine the political symbolism of Mao's grandson telling the Chinese press that's what North Korea should do. So there are signals the Chinese are sending to the outside world, but that signal should not be construed as a far-flung debate within the halls of Chinese power.
That was Dr. Chung Min Lee, an international affairs specialist at Yonsei University in Seoul, speaking with ABC Television's Jim Middleton. Indonesia's media is showing signs of being less free than some would like. With the rise of democracy in the country since 1999, print and electronic media outlets have mushroomed. However, as in many other countries around the world, ownership is becoming concentrated in fewer hands, often with predominant political connections. So what sort of barriers exist, and will this deepen business ties between Indonesia and its closest neighbor, Australia? Karen Snowden speaks next to John Ridley, the editor of the Jakarta Globe, when he visited Australia recently.
There are regulatory barriers, trade barriers, and things like that. But I'm not so sure that's the main issue. Ultimately, if businesses want to do business with each other, we'll find a solution. I think the fact that there are trade and investment barriers, that's somewhat secondary. The bigger issue is to get businesses to want to invest in each country to begin with. Right now, we see about $7 billion of investment from Australia to Indonesia and about 10% of that from Indonesia to Australia. I think we can see more, and more should happen. And I don't see that as an issue per se. The fact of the matter is Indonesia is right now at a stage of economic development where it needs more investment. I think the source of the investment is secondary. I'd welcome and I'd certainly help to facilitate more business investment from Indonesia to Australia and vice versa as well.
Putting your media hat on, how concerned are you over the government's, Indonesian government's, attempts to increase control over the media in Indonesia?
I'm not so concerned. They will not succeed in doing that. You know, first of all, we should remember that Indonesia has one of the freest presses in the world. And it is also a very competitive field. The issue, or at least a challenge with regard to freedom of speech is not so much government trying to intervene and control, which they absolutely cannot, but it is the consolidation of the media industry, which we've seen. And on a side note to that, the cross-ownership between people who have media interests and those with political interests as well. So that's the bigger challenge.
Do you have any plans to do more in Australia in the media?
We'd like to, if there's an opportunity. Australia is one of those countries where, on the one hand, we're so near. On the other hand, we're so different. That is also the source of the strength of our relationship, but also the source of challenges. As far as our personal interests, yeah, you know, we'd love to cover more of Australia. I think that's sort of maybe where we could come in. We would love to pay attention on more of the bilateral relationships so more people have an awareness of the issues, and both sides are better informed.
What about in getting more into the media business in Australia? Anything brewing there?
We'd love to. We've taken a look at a number of opportunities, but quite frankly, you know, Indonesia right now is in a more need of an investment. I think we can make a better impact there. You know, I think some of your media companies in Australia should take a look at Indonesia and see how you can bring some of your expertise there to our country.
Next year's election, any concerns about it and the change of government, you know, from your point of view?
2014 will be an important election for us. From the business community, I think we expect another free and fair elections. And there really is no major concern. If we recall in 1998 when Suharto stepped aside, there were two big concerns about the democratic transition. One is that it would be co-opted by radical Islam. And number two, it would be co-opted by the military. These are also the two concerns that countries like Egypt is today facing. But 14, 15 years down the road today, both of those concerns, I think we've allayed. So I think Indonesia is on firm footing on the democratic front, and we'll continue to do that. Yeah.
How well has the government of Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono done? Where would you say it's done a good job?
On the economic side, there is room for improvement, I think, but I think he's done well. And we have to remember that his government is a coalition government. So that's what we have to expect. So in light of those circumstances, I think he's done okay.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Australia has introduced new laws to deal with incursions by foreign fishing vessels. Two maritime power bills have passed the Australian Parliament to streamline enforcement and increase the powers of maritime officials. The government says border security is paramount, but critics say the laws are aggressive and send the wrong message to Australia's neighbours. Australia has 60,000 kilometres of coastline and is the world's largest fishing zone, and it wants to protect them. Border protection is also a huge political issue, as we hear from Karen Barlow.
Australia faces a litany of maritime threats which require constant vigilance, according to Australian Labor Senator Matt Thistlethwaite. He cites a recent example of three Indonesian fishermen who were convicted in Australia of illegal fishing.
The men were operating two boats, blast fishing, with explosives inside Australian waters in early October. Both vessels had chemicals on board, including TNT and detonators, to make small bombs for the purpose of fishing.
The new maritime laws are a streamlining of enforcement. There was duplication in legislation covering illegal fishing, customs, migration, quarantine, environmental protection and drug trafficking. The government says Australia's maritime agencies have been operating under 35 separate and varied pieces of legislation. Labor Senator Matt Thistlethwaite.
Operational agencies will not lose any powers that they currently have available to them. Significantly, the bill will provide a mechanism to implement and enforce international agreements that have a maritime enforcement aspect. For example, the bill will provide a comprehensive regime for Australia to implement its high seas boarding and inspection rights and obligations under regional fisheries agreements.
In other words, maritime officers from Customs, Defence and the Federal Police are getting increased powers. Greg Barnes from the Australian Lawyers Alliance.
The Commonwealth officials can detain persons, they can restrain people, and in fact, the Commonwealth seems to be trying to get around the problem of false imprisonment by saying that restraining a person is not an arrest. There's also provisions which protect Commonwealth officials from any acts that they do in relation to either going onto a boat or any dealing with a boat.
Maritime officers can also seize and destroy vessels under these laws. Greg Barnes says some provisions appear to go too far.
If people don't speak English, or the officer believes on reasonable grounds that the person does not speak English, they don't have to be informed of the offence for which they're being arrested. What has to happen under this particular legislation is that the officer has to take a person as soon as practicable before a magistrate. Now, again, that would seem to be an unfair provision because it doesn't set out, for example, that a person must have access to legal advice and that should be provided.
And that situation wouldn't happen to an Australian who was being arrested?
That would not happen to an Australian.
The target of these laws are fishermen, usually from Papua New Guinea and Indonesia. In the main, they are small, traditional operations. There's been a treaty covering traditional fishing in the Torres Strait, and Greg Barnes says the new Australian laws must have an impact.
One would have thought that a better approach for Australia would be to work cooperatively with those countries such as Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, rather than sending a signal that penalties have been increased, powers have been increased, and it's a concept of Fortress Australia.
Australia's opposition says it supports enforcing sovereignty at sea and using all options available to secure borders. The opposition wanted to include amendments to ensure asylum seeker boats could be turned around, but they were unsuccessful. Liberal Senator Maurice Payne.
Sadly, we are now seeing vessels in distress are being rescued by our border protection agencies, which have every legal right to return people to the closest place of practicable safety, but are not doing so. Instead, they are being treated as a water taxi service to facilitate asylum claims on the Australian people.
But Australian Greens Senator Lee Rhiannon says the new maritime laws send the wrong message to Australia's neighbours.
The Maritime Powers Bill is not a respectful way to deal with our neighbours. There's many concerns about how it treats traditional fishers as well as how we interact on a country-to-country basis.
The Australian government says safeguards are built into the legislation. It says border protection is a hard job in difficult circumstances and the officers involved in enforcing it need full support.
Karen Barlow reporting. They may have committed no crime, but children in Nepal often share the punishment meted out to their convicted parents. According to UNICEF, there are at least 80 children in Nepal imprisoned with their mothers in 74 jails across the country. And it's an issue the government of Nepal is failing to address. Kandahar Sapati has more.
Within Nepal, the state has no legal obligation to support the children of prisoners except those under the age of 2 who are given food and shelter alongside their parent in prison. But under Nepal's Children's Act of 1990-91, the country has a responsibility to protect them, says Thakur Chapagai, the child rights officer working with the NGO Child Welfare Scheme.
Governments will provide them the education opportunity and other facilities.
But is this actually happening?
Sometimes. But we have legal provision, but sometimes that happens or sometimes quite difficult to provide such education and other things.
Anil Chitrika, chair of the Himalayan Climate Initiative and a social worker, says while there are laws, there are no support systems to take innocent children out of the prison system.
The regulations that we have currently do not address the issues of children in prison. Now, the Nepali society is such that if one of the parents are in jail, then the children have to live with their parents because there is no support system. And so the state does not have any institution to take these children out.
Mr. Chitrakar says many of these children are deprived of their basic rights and face years of abuse and neglect. For those children who either choose to leave prison earlier or are forced to leave at the age of 18, they face abuse, trafficking and exploitation on the streets. Mr. Chapagai agrees that prison children are vulnerable to abuse and trafficking, but says lack of money and human resources makes it difficult for the problem to be addressed effectively.
It's quite difficult to solve the problem to children who are living in the streets and trafficked by relatives. It's quite difficult to solve the problem.
The government has established child reform centres in Bhaktapur and Sarangkot, but these are mainly for juvenile criminals where children of prisoners are sometimes sent to. To fill the gap and give the prison children hope, two Nepali women have come to the forefront. Indira Ranamagar started the Prisoners Association in Nepal, or PAN, in 2000. And among other things, rescues children from prisons and provide them with a safe home environment. Currently, she runs 4 homes across Nepal, housing some 300 children of prisoners.
Their children are helpless, so we rescue those children and giving shelter. These children has to have a provision for food and provision for education, provision for shelter like that. And many of the children They go to the street and they go to the child labor, and even they have abuse within the family, within the neighborhood. It's really serious, and the government doesn't do anything.
This program has not only given these children hope, but has also motivated parents to be gainfully employed, says Mr. Chitrakar.
So the parents also now feel that if they do not have to take care of their child in prison, meaning, you know, there's a third party that is helping to take it, then they are also involved in income generation. And so just as an example, you know, they might be doing something as simple as sewing or making clothes in the prison. And so they're also able to generate income so that they can support their children.
Pushpa Basnet was awarded the 2012 CNN Hero Award for giving shelter to more than 100 prison children since 2005. But despite her good work, she often comes across obstacles from the government, says Mr. Chitrakar.
Not only not doing anything, but even not cooperating, you know, with even allowing the children out of the prison. And he tells me that just dealing from one jailer to another itself is a challenge, because like I said, Nepal is a signatory to every international convention on child. But then when it comes to local level implementation, you know, A, the jailers are not aware, and neither are the local people.
And with our report from Karen Snowden, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. We're going to end you today with a little music from Singapore singer Sun Ho, who's going to be a guest on the program very soon. The song is called Where Did Love Go? Here's Sun Ho. We'll see you in 7 days. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.